Well, let me first say the same thing as many others. That is a bit, it's a great experience for me to be here in Seattle. It's my first visit to this beautiful part of the United States, which has so many links to Scandinavia. And I would like to share with you that yesterday, on the Norwegian Constitution Day of 17th of May, had the great pleasure of watching right here in Seattle in Ballard, what we Norwegian call a 17. Mai tog, which is a parade with national costumes, flags, and marching bands. It was a great experience, and I do take the liberty of showing you a picture from it, mainly because Tommy Sjöberg mentioned the Skandia dancing group in his paper about Gordon Tracy earlier today. And I maybe this is the same dancing group, I don't know, it was there. I also take the liberty of showing you a picture from the 17th of May in Oslo last year. It's a small girl waving her flag to her grandfather, which is me. I promised her to do this. So let's start. When I started working on this project, my main goal was to document the recordings of one specific Norwegian classical pianist. I became, however, quickly occupied with a much more interesting question of the classical recording as such, as a part of music history in the 20th century. That is to say, recordings not just as pictures or performances, and not just as memories of how did they play, but as musical artifacts, as part of a contemporary musical scene, even if they were recorded a long time before that. Now, one of my main concerns right from the beginning was obviously to find some suitable discographic tool for classical recordings. I might just well at once admit this strange addiction to lists of recordings. I don't know if this could be explained in medical terms, but having a computer background always gives you an excuse to try to write just another database system for your latest lists. However, with today's digital recording technology, this question also arises: is it always possible to document completely what's behind a release? What are the limits for discography as a research tool for sound recordings in general and classical music in particular? I shall return briefly to this question later, but let me first present two things. First, a perhaps well-known model for discographic information, and second, since the pianist in question didn't disappear completely, but was kept as a case study, my chosen tool for documenting his recordings. Let me present the model by briefly mentioning what kind of units we can find in classical recordings. What exactly are the units in the discography? Certainly not the physical phonograms itself, even if they are the easiest, maybe the only available documents of the recording event that once took place. Jazz discography documents instead the recording session. As I have understood, a jazz session is a collection of song recordings, often limited to one day's work, a song being defined by its chord sequence and by its melody line. The number of musicians on a given session is normally fixed, but may change from song to song. Songs are usually recorded in one or more takes. Each take is a complete version of the song. Arrangers are regarded as session musicians, not as authors or copyright holders. This is a problematic model for classical recordings. A classical session would normally take more than one day, in which just one piece would be recorded. The piece is unambiguous, fixed in its score, and uses a set number of musicians throughout the session. One take is usually just a small part of the piece. One such multi-day session could be a discographic unit. For classical music, I could use the word performance for this, regardless of the number of takes or session days. Or should we use the separate takes as units, a take being defined as a representation of the sound produced at one specific place within one specific time window? Before the tape recorder, the 78 matrix was, of course, such a take unit, and an ambiguous reference to the sound from a fixed time and place coordinate. Or, taken to the extreme, should we use the separate tracks or one take of a multi-track recording as units? And even if we decide what the units are, the performance, the takes, the tracks, we will have to document how they are used in one certain release. And this is just the recording side of the problem. In classical music, with a dependence on notation, we will have the question of which edition, what kind of cuts were made, instrument substitutes, and so on and so on. I did not find any discographic theory which handled all these possible requirements. What I did find, however, was a model for information retrieval from the library community, which called Functional Requirements for Bibliographic Records, or in short, FRBR. The international library community have the last 10 years or so been developing this model for describing the bibliographic universe, as they say, independent of any cataloging interpretation. And I take from the website, the FRBR is a recommendation of the International Library Association to restructure catalog databases to reflect the conceptual structure of information resources. It uses an entity relationship model for metadata for information objects. And as they say, it could produce the biggest change cataloging has seen in the last century. Now, the question was if this model is flexible enough to take care of the special needs for discographic research. Well, I'm not going to present FRBR in any detail, but this is the main principles. What you see here is the four so-called group one entities called work, expression, manifestation, and item, plus one so-called group two entity, person. Between the entities, we find relationships linking the entities together. The four group one entities go from a high to a lower level of abstraction. In musical terms, for example, work could be the abstract conceptual musical idea, like Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. Expression is another abstract, the realization of the work in any way, which poses a problem for music. A graphic realization and an audio realization are two different but juxtaposed expressions. Manifestation is the embodiment of an expression, which could be a published score or a known recording of the audio realization. An item is the physical object, the printed score, the physical master tape, the physical record in a collection. The FRBR model is very powerful, but has got its problem when it comes to music collections and discographic research. The performance is more often than not from a printed or written score, which means a work finding its manifestation in a printed score, which is used as a base for a performance, which is another expression, which is recorded, a new manifestation, and released after some signal processing. So let me try an attempt to adapt the FRBR model to a discographic use. I have split the expression and the manifestation boxes into two, each with their own interrelationship. I'm sure you can follow me through this small example. A work is realized in a score, which again is realized in a performance. The performance could be a real performance made in a certain venue at a certain time, or it could be an abstraction. The master is the embodiment of the performance. It was recorded, or if you go backwards, we do have a recording which defines the abstract performance for us. The master is released, that is another embodiment. We do have a catalog number for this release. The arrows show some of the possible relationship. Even within the same entity, a master may be processed to another master. We are not shown the items here. As in the former picture, all the entities has relationship to persons who create, realizes, transcribes, releases, and owns the things. In my view, I find the FRBR model very promising. It is, however, not a database solution. They will have to be written. And I have not made an attempt to do this, even if I could simplify the model to my specific needs. But I have been looking for solutions. One of those solutions is Brian, which I assure you know, the relational database application written for Jazz discographers and freely downloadable. It's a very fine application indeed, but in my view, more useful in jazz than in classical music. My solution was an unknown British database application called Sentences. Now, Sentences is a very strange animal, based on the database principle that the developer calls associative, in opposition to the normal relational database. Two advantages with Sentences is that, one, the data structure doesn't have to be determined in advance. It may, in fact, grow together with the data. And two, while a relational database would normally use a high number of tables, this database system uses just one. It must, however, be adapted to discographic use. This is not, however, a very big job. Sentences, let me follow up here, must be adapted. And Sentences is written in Java and runs on all platforms. A free evaluation version is downloadable from their website. And it must be said, it was not a huge success commercially, to put it mildly. The company went into receivership once, at least once, and when I asked if I could bring some material about the system to this conference, I was told that they had stopped any development for the time being. The commercial full-scale system was very expensive. It was a multi-user web-based system, and I think the price was between 50 and 100,000 British pounds. But to have it for free, for one user, was exactly what I needed. Still, I found that it was well suited to my tasks. And even more, when I much later learned about the FRBR model, I found it was very well suited to express FRBR-like constructions. So let me go shortly through this system. The name Sentences is not accidental. The association model uses two types of information, entities and associations. We are very close to the FRBR world here. Like this, we have a source and a target, which are entities, and they are connected by a verb to a sort of a sentence. That's the name. If I would document a musician and his recorded work, I could start by connecting a person and an instrument to give him a role like this. Name, place, and instrument. I do have a namespace, and I have an instrument space, and I connect those two. This association defines a role for a person in a musical context. An association may, in its turn, be both source and target. If I would like to document a performance, this can be done like this. Name, place, instrument, and this, again, this role performs in a venue. And I can add a date to it. Name, place, instrument, performs in a venue at a certain date. So what did he play? I can construct the musical work in the same way. Name, wrote, work, it can be the same namespace, the same name, the same person can be a musician and he can be a composer. And I can link those two together by putting performs between them. One of the good things with the associative database is that all associations may be many-to-many, if necessary, without any extra coding at all. Many musicians may play at the same performance. One work may be performed by many times by different artists. That is one obvious demand, of course, but still one which may mean problems when coding a relational database system. So to finish this, this performance is recorded on a master, and this master is released on the release. if I were going to describe this in FRBI terms again, the sentencing system, this is my system. To go back to my case study about the Norwegian pianist, my focus in this study is on the performance. As you can see, most of the associations are between performances and the other entities. It's a performance, it's a pointer to the venue, it's a pointer to the date, it's a pointer to the music, and to the artists. Just the recording itself has another pointer to a release. The entity music is simplified. It's a container for the composer and the title. I gave up. I did not have any use for having composer names in a separate namespace. So music is here, the connection of one composer and title. The same thing for artists, the container for the name and the instrument. The performance is an abstract, an expression in FRBR terms embodied in a master on tape. Very often, the master is unknown, and very often we don't know anything about the performance. All we have got is a release which points back to the it must have been some performance sometime. It might be an edited performance, but it is still what we know about. I will show you some screen dumps of this. This is how sentences construct the links from one entity. This is the links out of the performance entity. You can see I have a link to a date. I have, in fact, two date links, one approximate and one exact. I have a link to the music. I have a link to an artist. I have a link to a recording. I have a link to the venue. And I also link to notes and references and so on. The input, is it big enough to see? The input screen is made automatically for me. When I have defined the associations, this screen makes itself, and this is how I would enter data in for one performance. A performance has got an ID number. I can then put in the dates for the approximate date and the exact date, if I know it. And here I have put in the music. It's a sonata for violin and piano, number 3 by Edvard Grieg. And then the artists, which are of course one too many, so I can put as many artists as I want here. Robert Levin, which is his name. Unfortunately, there exist two Robert Levins playing piano, which don't make it very easy. One English, one American, and one Norwegian. They even play together. Yehde Menuhin, and he made a record. They made a record together in the 50s in London. I have no idea of the master tape ID. I have to give it a number, and the day and the performance venue in Abbey Road Studios, and eventually notes. I could, if the time permits, and it maybe permits, show you this thing live. Let's see if this is going to. This is sentences. Main input, and I can show you if I now select, hope you can see this, on an artist, I get a list of all the artists in the database. I can look for one, no, I can look for some music here, and I can look for the same Grieg recording, and I can find him down here somewhere, Opus 45, here we are. I can expand that, and I find 3 different recordings of this. I can expand that further. I find one with Levin and another violinist. I find one with Levin with Levin and American violinist Aaron Rosen, and I find, of course, the one we are looking for with Menuhin and Levin. I can click on each on this artist names, Menuhin, for example, and expand this again, and the system will find for me what other performances by Menuhin is in the database. I find three performances. I can click on one of them and find what is this. This is his Grieg's first sonata, and I can click on that again, expand that, and see what other recordings do we have of this sonata, and so on and so on. I have got two recordings. I can click on that, and so on. What I like with the system is the way I can walk through the data. Everything is connected to everything. It's a very informal way of finding out things. It may be not very effective, but it's for as a one user system, I can go through it like a web, so to say. But going back to the slide again, hopefully I will get some. It should be here somewhere. Yes, this is the same thing as you saw, but in a more fixed state. If I wanted output in other ways, I could export them as XML files. And I've done that, and you may transform them to whatever you want. This is a transformation to HTML for use at the website. This is just a list, of course. This is a fixed list of sorted here on the musicians. You see the same again, the Menuhin recordings. This is how I'm going to use it. But of course, this is a one way. It is not. I cannot go back again from this screen. So far, I've been able to make a discographic data system well suited to my own needs and fairly close to what I regard as good theory in the discographic field. But my needs have been fairly simple. What about the edits? What about the tracks? What about a score like this, for example? Yes, the red markings are the producer's notes during the session, and the blue markings is his notes after the session when he plots the score for the editor to make the edits. And as you can see, maybe just at the bottom of the page, keep cloning the green bracketed slice of take 967, that is 316 notes, until the next downbeat. And the green bracketed 16 notes is at the very top of the page, and he asks the poor editor then to clone this to fill up the bar, and you can see maybe down at the end of the page, the editor has written doesn't work, and I believe him. But how should one? How should one document things like this, even without the clones? And what about the multi-track information? This was an 8-track recording. It doesn't tell anything about that. It doesn't say anything about how the mixdown were and so on. So taken to its extreme, if one should really document the mapping between the recording and the releases, one could imagine this as maybe a way of doing it. I don't know if you know this. This is Karlheinz Stockhausen's electronic study number 2, made in 52. And what you have here is a map, is a complete map of the original units which the piece consists of. In this case, blocks of sine tones. That is the upper half. They tell us which sine tones this block consists of, and the level, which is the lower half, saying that we have a block of sign tones here, and it's a big table at the start in the preface, telling what sign tones goes into this block, and so the level is starting on a certain level and goes downwards, and the time units here is not in seconds but in magnetic tape centimeters. I don't think we can document things like that, really. I hope not. But it makes some questions. My question, I don't mean this really, but the use of digital processes in today's recording, even classical, makes it in practice impossible to substantiate what's behind the release. As recording and processing techniques have been developed the last 50 years, the release has become more and more impossible to look through as a link back to its origin. Several examples of this development can easily be found. We have Studio Pop, Workflow in classical recordings. One example is, for example, Philip Glass symphonies, which has been recorded with click track and in different venues all over the world, in fact. We have sampling as a construction unit of new music. The most controversial is not classical, of course. It is, let us, as example, use the Grey album, which I assure you all know, which are put together from Beatles tracks and some of the Beatles record companies were not very happy about this. And I might remind you of Glenn Gould's vision of the listener who himself would sample parts of various classical interpretations and put them together for his or her private enjoyment. Today, this, I don't know if somebody would like to do it, but it might be done very easily, but easily accessible and expensive software. And we have also the re-edits and noise processing of old masters, which make alternative presentations out of one historic master. So where does that lead us? Maybe to the conclusion that recordings more and more must be taken as at their face value, as it were. A classical recording could be regarded either as a patch of recording samples or as a picture of an ideal abstract performance. We are not any longer able to trace its origins in details. What started to disappear already with the shellacs and was completely gone together with the analog tape. So my conclusion is that discographic research as the excavation of a sound object history is connected to analog sources. In the digital era, it has come to an end and will be replaced by analysis by the sound object itself, unmarked by any historical knowledge.
Yeah.